"You know?" exclaimed Pod.
"Yes, of course I know. I've got the grey tin."
"Well," said Pod ponderously, "if you go outside this room, what do you see?"
"A dark passage," said Arietti.
"And what else?"
"Other rooms."
"And if you go farther?"
"More passages."
"And if you go walking on and on in all the passages under the floor, what do you find?"
"Gates," said Arietti.
"Strong gates," said Pod. "Gates you can't open."
"What are they there for?" "Against the mice," said Arietti.
"Yes," agreed Pod uncertainly, as though he gave her half a mark. "But mice never hurt no one."
"What else?" "Rats," suggested Arietti.
"We don't have rats," said Pod. "What about cats?"
"Cats," echoed Arietti, surprised.
"Or to keep you in," suggested Pod.
"To keep me in?" repeated Arietti, dismayed.
"Upstairs is a dangerous place," said Pod. "And you, Arietti, are all we've got, see? It isn't like Hendrieri. He still has two of his own and three of hers." "Once," said Pod, "Hendrieri had three. Three of his own."
"Your father's thinking of Eglantina," said Homily.
"Yes," said Pod. "Eglantina. They never told her about upstairs. And they hadn't got no grating. They told her the sky was nailed up like with cracks in it."
"A foolish way to bring up a child," murmured Homily. She sniffed slightly and touched Arietti's hair.
"But Eglantina was no fool," said Pod. "She didn't believe them. So one day she went upstairs to see for herself."
"How did she get out?" asked Arietti.
"Well, we didn't have so many gates then, just the one under the clock. Hendrieri must have left it unlocked. Anyway, Eglantina went out."
"In a blue dress," said Homily, "and a pair of button boots your father made her. Yellow kid with jet beads for buttons. Lovely they were."
"Well," said Pod, "any other time it might have been all right. She'd have gone out, had a look round, had a bit of a fright maybe, and come back. None the worse and none the wiser."
"But things had been happening," said Homily.
"Yes," said Pod. "She didn't know, as they never told her, that her father had been seen, and that upstairs they had got in the cat, and..."
"They waited a week," said Homily, "and they waited a month, and they hoped for a year, but no one never saw Eglantina no more."
"And that," said Pod, eyeing Arietti, "is what happened to Eglantina."
There was a silence, except for Pod's breathing and the faint bubble of soup. "It just broke up your Uncle Hendrieri," said Homily at last. "He never went upstairs again, in case, he said, he found the button boots. Their only future was to emigrate." Arietti raised her head. "Why did you tell me?" she asked. "Now, tonight." Homily got up. She moved restlessly towards the stove. "We don't never talk about it," she said. "But tonight we felt, well, your father's been seen, Arietti."
"Oh," said Arietti. "Who by?"
"Well, by a... something you've never heard of, but that's not the point. The point is, you think they'll get a cat?"
"They might," said Homily. Arietti set down the soup. She stared into the cup as it stood beside her on the floor. There was a dreamy, secret something about her lowered face.
"Couldn't we emigrate?" she ventured at last, very softly. Homily gasped and clasped her hands and swung away towards the wall. "You don't know what you're talking about," she cried. "Worms and weasels and cold and damp and..."
"But supposing," said Arietti,
the eye went out, like Eglantina did, and the cat ate me. Then you and Papa would emigrate, wouldn't you? She asked, and her voice faltered. Wouldn't you? Homily swung round. Her face looked very angry. I shall smack you, Arietti Clock, if you don't behave yourself this minute. Arietti's eyes filled with tears.
I was only thinking, she said, that I'd like to be there to emigrate too. Uneaten, she added softly, and the tears fell.
No, said Pod, this is enough. You go off to bed, Arietti, uneaten and unbeaten both, and we'll talk about this in the morning.
It's not that I'm afraid, cried Arietti angrily. I like cats. I bet the cat didn't eat Eglantina. I bet she just ran away because she hated being cooped up day after day, week after week, year after year, like I do, she added on a sob. Cooped up, repeated Homily, astounded.
Arietti put her face into her hands.
Gates, she gasped. Gates, gates, gates.
Pod and Homily stared at each other across Arietti's bowed shoulders.
You didn't ought to have brought it up, he said unhappily. Not so late at night.
Arietti raised her tear-streaked face.
Late or early, what's the difference? Oh, I know Papa is a wonderful borrower. I know we've managed to stay when all the others have gone. But what has it done for us? I don't think it's so clever to live on alone in a great big half-empty house, under the floor, with no one to talk to, no one to play with, no light but candlelight and firelight and what comes through the cracks. Eglantina had brothers, and Eglantina had half-brothers. Eglantina had a tame mouse, and Eglantina did get out, just once.
Shush, said Pod gently.
Not so loud. Above their heads, heavy footfalls heaved deliberately to and fro. They heard Mrs. Driver's grumbling voice and the clatter of the fire irons. They heard her call,
Cranfer!
Homily drew a long, slow breath. Suddenly she raised her head.
The child is right, she announced firmly.
Arietti's eyes grew big.
Oh, no, she began. It shocked her to be right. Parents were right, not children. Children could say anything Arietti knew and enjoy saying it, knowing always that they were safe and wrong.
You see, Pod, went on Homily, it was different for you and me. There were other families, other children. We had more, as you might say, freedom. Ah, yes, said Pod. In a way. But where does freedom take you? He looked up uncertainly. Where are they all now?
Some of them may have bettered themselves, said Homily sharply. Times have changed in the whole house. There were those who went when they dug a trench for the gas pipe. A kind of tunnel it gave them, all the way to Leighton Buzzard.
And what did they find there? Said Pod unkindly. A mountain of coke.
Homily turned away.
Arietti, she said in the same firm voice, supposing one day we pick a special day when there was no one about, supposing one day your father took you out borrowing, you'd be a good girl, wouldn't you? You'd do just what he said, quickly and quietly, and no arguing.
Arietti turned quite pink.
Oh,
she began in an ecstatic voice, but Pod cut in quickly.
Now, Homily, we've got to think. I've been seen, remember? This is no kind of time for taking a child upstairs. I never heard of no girl going borrowing before.
The way I look at it, said Homily, if you had a son, you'd take him borrowing now, wouldn't you?
Well, you haven't got no son, only Arietti. Suppose anything happened to you or me, where would Arietti be if she hadn't learned to borrow?
Pod stared down at his knees. Yes, he said after a moment. I see what you mean.
It'll give her a bit of interest, like, and stop her hankering.
Hankering for what?
For blue sky and grass and such like.
Arietti caught her breath and Homily turned on her swiftly. It's no use, Arietti. I'm not going to emigrate, not for you nor anyone else.
Arr, said Pod, and began to laugh. So that's it.
Shush, said Homily, annoyed. Now kiss your father, Arietti, she went on briskly, and pop off to bed.
As Arietti snuggled down under the bedclothes, she felt, creeping up from her toes, a glow of happiness, like a glow of warmth. She heard their voices rising and falling in the next room, Homily measured and confident. There was, Arietti felt, a kind of conviction behind it. It was the winning voice. Once she heard Pod get up and the scrape of a chair.
I don't like it, she heard him say.
And she heard Homily whisper, hush. For the next 3 weeks, Arietti was especially good. She helped her mother tidy the storerooms. She cut old kid gloves into squares for Pod's shoemaking. She hung up the washing to dry by the grating so that it blew in the soft air. And at last, the day came. That dreadful, wonderful, never-to-be-forgotten day when Homily, scrubbing the kitchen table, straightened her back and called, Pod? He came in from his workroom, last in hand. Look at this brush, cried Homily. It was a fibre brush with a plaited fibre back.
Aye, said Pod, worn down.
Gets my knuckles now, said Homily, every time I scrub.
Pod looked worried. Since he had been seen, they had stuck to kitchen borrowing and bare essentials of fuel and food.
Mrs. Driver's out, Homily went on. It's her day off. And she, they always spoke of Aunt Sophie as she, is safe enough in bed.
It's not them that worries me, said Pod.
Why? Exclaimed Homily sharply. The boy's not still here.
I don't know, said Pod. There's always a risk.
And there always will be, retorted Homily. It's not like you to talk about risks.
Pod sighed.
All right, he said,
and turned away to fetch his borrowing bag.
Take the child, called Homily after him.
Pod turned. Now, Homily, he began in an alarmed voice.
Why not? Asked Homily sharply. It's just the day. You aren't going no farther than the front door. Let her just see, at any rate. Arietti!
As Arietti came running in, Pod tried again.
No, listen, Homily, he protested.
Homily ignored him.
Arietti, she said brightly, would you like to go along with your father and borrow me some brush fibre from the doormat in the hall?
Arietti gave a little skip.
Oh, she cried. Could I?
Well, take your apron off, said Homily, and change your boots. You want light shoes for borrowing.
Better wear the red kid. And then, as Arietti spun away, Homily turned to Pod.
She'll be all right, she said.
You'll see.
As she followed her father down the passage, Arietti's heart began to beat faster. Now the moment had come at last, she found it almost too much to bear. They had 3 borrowing bags between the two of them.
In case, Pod had explained, we pick up something. A bad borrower loses many a chance for the lack of an extra bag.
And Pod laid these down to open the first gate, which was latched by a safety pin. It was a big pin, and Arietti watched her father swing his whole weight on the bar and his feet kick loose off the ground. Hanging from his hands, he shifted his weight along the pin towards the curved sheath, and as he moved, the pin sprang open and he, in the same instant, jumped free.
You couldn't do that, he remarked.
Too light.
nor could your mother.
Come along now.
Quietly. There were other gates, all of which Pod left open.
Never shut a gate on the way out, he explained. You might need to get back quick.
And after a while, Arietti saw a faint light at the end of the passage. She pulled her father's sleeve.
Is that it? She whispered.
Yes, that's it. The hole under the clock.
There are 3 steps up to it, Pod went on. Steep-like, so mind how you go.
When you're under the clock, you just stay there. If all's clear, I'll give you the sign.
As Arietti scrambled past the jagged edges of the hole, she had a sudden blinding glimpse of molten gold. It was spring sunshine on the pale stones of the hall floor. Standing upright, she could no longer see this. She could only see the cave-like shadows in the great case above her and the dim outline of the hanging weights. The hollow darkness vibrated with sound, and far above her head, she saw the movement of the pendulum. It gleamed a little in the half-light, remote and cautious in its rhythmic swing. Arietti felt warm tears behind her eyelids and a sudden swelling pride. So this, at last, was the clock. Their clock, after which her family was named. But Pod, she saw, stood crouched beneath the carved archway against the light. So Arietti crouched too. Pod's eyes slewed round.
Wait, he breathed. And watch.
And then, in a flash, he was gone. Arietti saw him scurry across the sunlit floor. Swiftly he ran, as a mouse runs. And suddenly, she saw him as small. But she told herself, he isn't small. He's half a head taller than Mother. She watched him run around a chestnut-coloured island of doormat into the shadows beside the door. There, it seemed, he became invisible. Arietti watched and waited. All was still, except for a sudden whir within the clock above her head, then the sliding grate of slipped metal before the clock sang out its chime. 3 notes were struck, deliberate and mellow. Take it or leave it, they seemed to say. But that's the time. A sudden movement near the shadowed lintel of the front door, and there was Pod again, bag in hand, beside the mat. It rose knee-deep before him like a field of chestnut corn. Arietti saw him glance towards the clock, and then she saw him raise his hand. Oh, the warmth of the stone flags as she ran across them, the gladdening sunlight on her face and hands, the awful space above and around her. Pod caught her and held her at last and patted her shoulder.
There, there, he said. Get your breath back. Good girl.
Panting a little, Arietti gazed about her. She saw great chair legs rearing up into sunlight. She saw the shadowed undersides of their seats spread above her like canopies. She saw the nails and the strapping and the odd tags of silk and string. She saw the terraced cliffs of the stairs mounting up into the distance, up and up. And all the time in the stillness, the clock spoke, measuring out the seconds, spreading its layers of calm. And then turning, Arietti looked at the garden. She saw a graveled path full of coloured stones, with here and there a blade of grass between them, transparent green against the light of the sun. Beyond the path, she saw a grassy bank rising steeply to a tangled hedge. And beyond the hedge, she saw fruit trees, bright with blossom.
"Here's a bag," said Pod in a hoarse whisper. "Better get down to work."
Obediently, Arietti started pulling fibre. Stiff it was and full of dust. Pod worked swiftly and methodically, making small bundles, each of which he put immediately in the bag.
"It hurts your hands," said Arietti, "doesn't it?"
And she sneezed.
"Not my hands, it doesn't," said Pod. "They're hardened, like."
And Arietti sneezed again.
"Dusty, isn't it?"
she said. Pod straightened his back. You leave it. It's your first time up, like. You sit on the step there and take a peek out of doors.
Oh, no, Arietta began. If I don't help, she thought, he won't want me again. But Pod insisted.
I'm better on my own, he said. I can choose my bits, if you see what I mean, seeing as it's me who's got to make the brush.
The step was warm, but very steep. If I got down onto the path, Arietta thought, I might not get up again. So for some moments she sat quietly. After a while, she noticed the shoe scraper.
Arietta, called Pod softly, where have you got to?
I just climbed down the shoe scraper, she called back. He came along and looked down at her from the top of the step.
That's all right, he said after a moment's stare, but never climb down anything that isn't fixed, like. Supposing one of them came along and moved the shoe scraper, how would you get up again?
This path, Arietta said, goes round the house, and the bank does too.
Well, said Pod, what of it?
Arietta rubbed one red kid's shoe on a rounded stone. It's my grating, she explained. I was thinking that my grating must be just round the corner. My grating looks out on this bank.
Your grating, said Pod. Since when has it been your grating?
I was thinking, Arietta went on, suppose I went round the corner and called through the grating to Mother.
No, said Pod. We're not going to have none of that. Not going round corners.
But then, went on Arietta, she'd see I was all right, like.
Well, said Pod, and then he half smiled. Go quickly then and call. I'll watch for you here. Not loud, mind.
Arietta ran. The stones in the path were firmly bedded, and her light, soft shoes hardly seemed to touch them. How glorious it was to run! You could never run under the floor. You walked, you stopped, you crawled, but you never ran. Arietta nearly ran past the grating. She saw it just in time after she turned the corner. Yes, there it was, quite close to the ground, embedded deeply in the old wall of the house. There was moss below it, in a spreading greenish stain. Arietta ran up to it. Mother! She called, her nose against the iron grill. Mother! She waited quietly, and after a moment she called again. At the third call, Homily came. Her hair was coming down, and she carried, as though it were heavy, the screw lid of a pickle jar filled with soapy water. Oh! She said in an annoyed voice. You didn't half give me a turn. What do you think you're up to? Where's your father? Arietta jerked her head sideways. Just there, by the front door. She was so full of happiness that out of Homily's sight, her toes danced on the green moss. Here she was on the other side of the grating. Here she was at last, on the outside, looking in.
Yes, said Homily. They opened that door like that the first day of spring. Well, she went on briskly, you run back to your father and tell him if the morning door happens to be open that I wouldn't say no to a bit of red blotting paper. Mind out of my way now while I throw the water.
That's what grows the moss, thought Arietta as she sped back to her father. All the water we empty through the grating.
Pod looked relieved when he saw her, but frowned at the message. How she expect me to climb that desk without my pin? Blotting paper's a curtain and chair job, and she should know it. Come on now, up with you.
Let me stay down, pleaded Arietta, just a bit longer, just till you finish. They're all out, except her. Mother said so.
She'd say anything, grumbled Pod, when she wants something quick. How does she know that boy ain't still here?
What boy? Asked Arietta.
Pod looked embarrassed. What boy? He repeated vaguely, and then went on, or maybe Crampferl.
Crampferl isn't a boy, said Arietta.
No, he isn't, said Pod. No, He went on as though thinking this out. No, you couldn't call Cramford a boy. Not as you might say, a boy, exactly. Well, he said, beginning to move away, stay down a bit if you like, but stay close.
Arietti watched him move away from the step, and then she looked about her.
Oh, glory! Oh, joy! Oh, freedom!
The sunlight, the grasses, the soft moving air, and halfway up the bank where it curved round the corner, a flowering cherry tree. Below it on the path lay a stain of pinkish petals, and at the tree's foot, pale as butter, a nest of primroses. Arietti threw a cautious glance toward the front doorstep, and then light and dancy in her soft red shoes, she ran towards the petals. They were curved like shells and rocked as she touched them. She gathered several up and laid them, one inside the other, up and up like a card castle, and then she spilled them. Pod came again to the top of the step and looked along the path.
Don't you go far, he said after a moment.
Seeing his lips move, she smiled back at him. She was too far already to hear the words. Cautiously, she moved towards the bank and climbed a little nervously in amongst the green blades. As she parted them gently with her bare hands, drops of water plopped on her skirt, and she felt the red shoes becoming damp. But on she went, pulling herself up now and again by rooty stems into this jungle of moss and wood violet and creeping leaves of clover. The sharp-seeming grass blades, waist-height, were tender to the touch and sprang back lightly behind her as she passed. When at last she reached the foot of the tree, the bird took fright and flew away, and she sat down suddenly on a gnarled leaf of primrose. The air was filled with scent. But nothing will play with you, she thought, and saw the cracks and furrows of the primrose leaves held crystal beads of dew. If she pressed the leaf, these rolled like marbles. The bank was warm, almost too warm here within the shelter of the tall grass, and the sandy earth smelled dry. Standing up, she picked a primrose. The pink stalk felt tender and living in her hands, and was covered with silvery hairs, and when she held the flower like a parasol between her eyes and the sky, she saw the sun's pale light through the veined petals. She lay back among the stalks of the primroses, and they made a coolness between her and the sun, and then, sighing, she turned her head and looked sideways up the bank among the grass stems. Startled, she caught her breath. Something had moved above her on the bank. Something had glittered. Arietti stared. It was an eye, or it looked like an eye, clear and bright like the colour of the sky, an eye like her own, but enormous, a glaring eye. Breathless with fear, she sat up, and the eye blinked. A great fringe of lashes came curving down and flew up again out of sight. Cautiously, Arietti moved her legs. She would slide noiselessly on among the grass stems and slither away down the bank.
"Don't move," said a voice.
And the voice, like the eye, was enormous, but somehow hushed and hoarse, like a surge of wind through the grating on a stormy night. Arietti froze.
So this is it, she thought. The worst and the most terrible thing of all. I have been seen. Whatever happened to Eglantina will now almost certainly happen to me.
There was a pause, and Arietti, her heart pounding in her ears, heard the breath again drawn swiftly into the vast lungs.
Or, said the voice, whispering still, I shall hit you with my ash stick.
Suddenly, Arietti became calm.
Why? She asked.
How strange her own voice sounded. Crystal thin and harebell clear, it tinkled on the air.
In case,
came the surprised whisper at last. You ran towards me, quickly through the grass. In case, it went on, trembling a little, you scrabbled at me with your nasty little hands.
Arietti stared at the eye. She held herself quite still.
Why?
She asked again. And again the word tinkled. Icy cold it sounded this time, and needle sharp.
Things do, said the voice. I've seen them. In India.
Arietti thought of her gazetteer of the world.
You're not in India now, she pointed out.
Did you come out of the house?
Yes, said Arietti.
From whereabouts in the house?
Arietti stared at the eye.
I'm not going to tell you, she said at last bravely.
Then I'll hit you with my ash stick.
All right, said Arietti.
Hit me. I'll pick you up and break you in half.
Arietti stood up.
All right, she said, and took two paces forward.
There was a sharp gasp and an earthquake in the grass. He spun away from her and sat up, a great mountain in a green jersey. He had fair straight hair and golden eyelashes.
Stay where you are, he cried.
Arietti stared up at him.
So this was the boy.
Breathless, she felt, and light with fear.
I guessed you were about 9, she gasped after a moment.
He flushed.
Well, you're wrong. I'm 10.
He looked down at her, breathing deeply.
How old are you?
14, said Arietti.
Next June, she added, watching him. There was silence while Arietti waited, trembling a little.
Can you read? The boy said at last.
Of course, said Arietti. Can't you?
No, I mean, yes. I mean, I've just come from India.
But what's that got to do with it? Asked Arietti.
Well, if you're born in India, you're bilingual. And if you're bilingual, you can't read. Well, not so well.
Arietti stared up at him.
What a monster, she thought, dark against the sky.
Do you grow out of it? She asked.
He moved a little, and she felt the cold flick of his shadow.
Oh, yes, he said. It wears off. My sisters were bilingual. Now they aren't a bit. They could read any of those books upstairs in the schoolroom.
So could I, said Arietti quickly. If someone could hold them and turn the pages. I'm not a bit bilingual. I can read anything.
Can you read out loud?
Of course, said Arietti. Would you wait here while I run upstairs and get a book now?
Well, said Arietti. She was longing to show off. Then a startled look came into her eyes.
Oh, she faltered.
What's the matter? The boy was standing up now. He towered above her.
How many doors are there to this house? She squinted up at him against the bright sunlight.
Doors, he said. Outside doors?
Yes.
Well, there's the front door, the back door, the gunroom door, the kitchen door, the scullery door, and the French windows in the drawing room.
Well, you see, said Arietti, my father's in the hall by the front door working. He wouldn't want to be disturbed.
Working? Said the boy.
What at?
Getting material, said Arietti, for a scrubbing brush.
Then I'll go in the side door. He began to move away, but turned suddenly and came back to her. He stood a moment as though embarrassed, and then he said,
Can you fly?
No, said Arietti, surprised.
Can you?
His face became even redder.
Of course not, he said angrily. I'm not a fairy.
Well, nor am I, said Arietti.
Nor is anybody. I don't believe in them.
He looked at her strangely.
You don't believe in them?
No, said Arietti. Do you?
Of course not.
Really, she thought, he is a very angry kind of boy.
My mother believes in them, she said, trying to appease him. She thinks she saw one once, when she was a girl behind the sand pile in the potting shed.
He squatted down on his heels, and she felt his breath on her face.
What was it like? He asked. About the size of a glowworm, with wings like a butterfly, and it had a tiny little face, she said, all alight and moving like sparks and tiny moving hands. Its face was changing all the time, she said, smiling and sort of shimmering.
Oh, said the boy, interested. After a moment he asked, Where did it go?
It just went, said Arietti. When my mother saw it, it seemed to be caught in a cobweb. It was dark at the time, about 5 o'clock on a winter's evening, after tea.
Oh, he said again, and picked up 2 petals of cherry blossom, which he folded together like a sandwich and ate slowly.
Supposing, he said, you saw a little man, about as tall as a pencil, with a blue patch in his trousers, halfway up a curtain, carrying a doll's teacup. Would you say it was a fairy?
No, said Arietti. I'd say it was my father.
Oh, said the boy. Does your father have a blue patch on his trousers?
Not on his best trousers. He does on his borrowing ones.
Oh, said the boy again. He seemed to find it a safe sound, as lawyers do. Are there many people like you?
No, said Arietti. None. We're all different.
I mean as small as you.
Arietti laughed.
Oh, don't be silly. Surely you don't think there are many people in the world your size?
There are more my size than yours, he retorted.
Honestly, began Arietti and laughed again. Do you really think, I mean, whatever sort of world would it be? Those great chairs, I've seen them. Fancy if you had to make chairs that size for everyone. And the stuff for their clothes, miles and miles of it, and the sewing. And the great houses, reaching up so you can hardly see the ceilings. Their great beds, the food they eat, great smoking mountains of it. Huge bogs of soup and stew and stuff.
Well, don't you eat soup? Asked the boy.
Of course we do, laughed Arietti. My father had an uncle who had a little boat, which he rowed round in the stock pot, picking up flotsam and jetsam. But all that stock? Fathoms of it. I mean, there wouldn't be enough stuff in the world to go round after a bit. That's why my father says it's a good thing they're dying out. Just a few, my father says. That's all we need to keep us. Otherwise, he says, the whole thing gets...
Arietti hesitated, trying to remember the word.
Exaggerated, he says.
What do you mean?
Asked the boy. To keep us.
So Arietti told him about borrowing, how difficult it was and how dangerous. She told him about the storerooms under the floor, about Pod's early exploits, the skill he had shown and the courage. She described those far-off days before her birth, when Pod and Homily had been rich. She described the musical snuff-box of gold filigree, and the little bird which flew out of it made of kingfisher feathers, how it flapped its wings and sang its song. She described the tiny green glasses, the little silver teapot out of the drawing-room case, the satin bed-covers in embroidered sheets.
Those we have still, she told him. They're her handkerchiefs.
She, the boy realized gradually, was his great-aunt Sophie. He heard how Pod would borrow from her bedroom, picking his way in the firelight among trinkets on her dressing-table, and of how she would watch him, and sometimes talk to him because, Arietti explained, every day at 6 o'clock they brought her a decanter of fine old pale Madeira, and how after the first 3 glasses Great-Aunt Sophie never believed in anything she saw.
She thinks my father comes out of the decanter, said Arietti.
I wish she thought I came out of the decanter, said the boy. She gives me dictation and teaches me to write. I only see her in the mornings when she's cross. She sends for me and looks behind my ears and asks Mrs. D if I've learned my words.
What does Mrs. D look like? Asked Arietti. How delicious it was to say Mrs. D like that. How careless and daring.
She's fat and has a moustache
and says she'll take a slipper to me one of these days." The boy pulled up a tuft of grass and stared at it angrily, and Arietti saw his lip tremble. "My mother's nice," he said. "She lives in India." "Why did you lose all your worldly riches?"
"Well," said Arietti, "the kitchen boiler burst, and hot water came pouring through the floor into our house, and everything got washed away and piled up in front of the grating. My father worked night and day trying to salvage things, and there's a dreadful draught in March through that grating. He got ill, you see, and couldn't go borrowing. So my Uncle Hendreary had to do it, and one or two others, and my mother gave them things bit by bit for their trouble. But the kingfisher bird was spoilt by the water. All its feathers fell off, and a great twirly spring came jumping out of its side. After a while I got born, and my father went borrowing again. But he gets tired now, and he doesn't like curtains, not when any of the baubles are off." "I helped him a bit," said the boy, "with the teacup. He was shivering all over. I suppose he was frightened."
"My father frightened?" exclaimed Arietti angrily. "Frightened of you?" she added.
"Perhaps he doesn't like heights," said the boy.
"He loves heights," said Arietti. "The thing he doesn't like is curtains. I've told you, curtains make him tired."
The boy sat thoughtfully on his haunches, chewing a blade of grass.
"Borrowing," he said after a while. "Is that what you call it?"
"What else could you call it?" asked Arietti.
"I'd call it stealing."
Arietti laughed. She really laughed.
"But we are borrowers," she explained. "Like, you're a human being. We're part of the house. You might as well say that the fire grate steals the coal from the coal scuttle."
"Then what is stealing?"
Arietti looked grave.
"Supposing my Uncle Hendreary borrowed an emerald watch from her dressing table, and my father took it and hung it up on our wall. That's stealing."
"An emerald watch?" exclaimed the boy.
"Well, I just said that because we have one on our wall at home, but my father borrowed it himself. Borrowers don't steal."
"Well, except from human beings," said the boy.
Arietti burst out laughing. She laughed so much that she had to hide her face in the primrose.
"Oh, dear," she gasped. "You are funny. Human beings are for borrowers, like breads for butter."
The boy was silent a while. A sigh of wind rustled the cherry tree and shivered among the blossom.
"Well, I don't believe it," he said at last, watching the falling petals. "I don't believe that's what we're here for at all, and I don't believe we're dying out."
"Oh, goodness," exclaimed Arietti impatiently. "Just use your common sense. You're the only real human being I ever saw. But I know lots and lots of borrowers. The overmantels, and the harpsichords, and the rain barrels, and the linen presses, and the Hon John Studdingtons, and..."
He looked down.
"John Studdington?
But he was our granduncle."
"Well, this family lived behind a picture," went on Arietti, "and there were the bell pulls and the..."
"Yes,"
he interrupted.
"But did you see them?"
"I saw the harpsichords, and my mother was a bell pull. The others were before I was born."
He leaned closer.
"Then where are they now? Tell me that."
"My Uncle Hendreary has a house in the country," said Arietti coldly, "and five children, harpsichords and clocks."
"But where are the others?"
"Oh, they're somewhere."
"But where?" she wondered. And she shivered slightly in the boy's cold shadow which lay about her, slantwise on the grass. He drew back again, his fair head blocking out a great piece of sky.
"Well," he said deliberately, and his eyes were cold, "I've only seen two borrowers, but I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds..."
"Oh, no," whispered Arietti, "of human beings."
And he sat back. Arietti did not look at him. After a while, she said,
I don't believe you.
All right, he said.
Then I'll tell you. I still won't believe you, murmured Arietti.
Listen, he said. And he told her about railway stations and football matches and racecourses and royal processions and Albert Hall concerts. He told her about India and China and North America. Not hundreds, he said, but thousands and millions and billions and trillions of great, big, enormous people. Now do you believe me?
Arietti stared up at him with frightened eyes. I don't know, she whispered.
As for you, he went on, leaning closer again, I don't believe that there are any more borrowers anywhere in the world. I believe you're the last three, he said.
Arietti dropped her face into the primrose.
We're not. There's Aunt Luppy and Uncle Hendreary and all the cousins. I bet they're dead, said the boy. And what's more, he went on, no one will ever believe I've seen you. And you'll be the very last because you're the youngest. One day, he told her, smiling triumphantly, you'll be the only borrower left in the world.
He sat still, waiting. But she did not look up.
Now you're crying, he remarked after a moment.
They're not dead, said Arietti in a muffled voice. They live in a badger's set 2 fields away beyond the spinney.
What spinney? He asked.
I don't know, Arietti almost shouted. It's along by the gas pipe, a field called Parkin's Beck. She blew her nose. I'm going home.
Oh, don't go, he said, not yet. Let me just get the book, he pleaded.
I'm not going to read to you now, said Arietti.
Why not?
She looked at him with angry eyes.
Because... Listen, he said. I'll go to that field. I'll go and find Uncle Hendreary and the cousins and Aunt whatever she is. And if they're alive, I'll tell you. What about that? You could write them a letter and I'd put it down the hall.
Arietti gazed at him.
Would you? She breathed. Yes, I would. Really, I would. Now can I go and get the book?
All right, said Arietti. Her eyes were shining. When can I give you the letter?
Any time, he said. Where in the house do you live?
Well, began Arietti and stopped. Why once again did she feel this chill? Could it only be his shadow, towering above her, blotting out the sun?
I'll put it somewhere, she said hurriedly. I'll put it under the hall mat.
The one by the front door?
Yes, that one.
He was gone. And she stood alone in the sunshine, shoulder deep in the grass. What had happened seemed too big for thought. Not only had she been seen, but she had been talked to. Not only had she been talked to, but she had...
Arietti, said a voice.
She spun round. There was Pod, moon-faced on the path, looking up at her.
Come on down, he whispered.
She stared at him for a moment, as though she did not recognize him. How round his face was. How kind. How familiar.
Come on, he said, more urgently.
And because he sounded worried, she slithered quickly towards him off the bank, balancing her primrose.
Put that thing down.